Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco Bay Area 91.7 FM. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. If you await the program on probating the small estate, that program's been delayed a few weeks. Our topic tonight includes claims of sovereignty. That is, I can live amongst you, but your laws don't apply to me. The term sovereign citizen may refer to domestic terrorists or just someone trying to finagle a way around a traffic ticket or avoiding paying taxes or even child support. Just what is a sovereign citizen? Why should we care? If you have questions for my guest, or if you are personally familiar with claims of sovereignty, or if you're just curious, give us a call. We respect your privacy, but we'd really like to hear from you. Our phone number right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, and for those that aren't so sure, if you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll-free. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can contact us with any question on tonight's topic. You don't have to jump in exactly where we may be in our conversation. And as always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all the salient facts of your situation, but we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. With me tonight is David Nazaro, attorney in San Mateo, California. David has literally done his homework with a master's in this area, can tell us a lot about the origins of this whole line of thinking, how it manifests itself, whether it's family support orders or traffic tickets, really where most of us might travel, where most of us live. David, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. Fun to be back with you tonight. Always a good time to be in the studio with you.
You know, I guess where I would start is start with the basics. What is a sovereign citizen?
Well, definitions are a great place to start. The term sovereign citizen is a catch-all phrase, referring to a variety of anti-government individuals and groups who share some common beliefs and behaviors. The organizations to which many sovereign citizens belong also have a variety of names. They go by names such as Moorish Nation, the Aware Group, Washita Nation, the North Carolina American Republic, Republic of the United States of America. These views may be embraced by groups calling themselves names such as Free Man, Free Men on the Land, Sons of Liberty, and Aryan Nation. But many sovereign citizens don't affiliate with any of these groups. In some way, all sovereign citizens, whether tied to an organization or not, adhere to a view that the existing American governmental structure, including the courts and law enforcement, is illegitimate, and that they, the sovereign citizens, retain an individual common law identity exempting them from the authority of those fraudulent government institutions.
So to put it another way, would it be fair to say that it's a loose grouping of people that they may be litigants, they may be commentators or tax protesters or whatever it may be, who see themselves as answerable only to their own particular interpretation of what they see as common law and not subject to any government laws or proceedings, the courts or anything? They just don't recognize their authority over them.
It's fair to say that. It's also fair to say that they understand the law to be whatever someone on YouTube has told them.
In looking, researching tonight's show, I found that the Southern Poverty Law Center says that there's a couple hundred thousand of these so-called sovereign citizens, but some might be simply using the doctrine to dodge a traffic ticket or something like that, but about half of them are pretty hardcore.
It's impossible to say how many people belong to this ideological group. No one could possibly take some type of census on that. It is believed that the majority are harmless people, that they're simply individuals who quite possibly got a traffic ticket or somehow got involved with the courts or into some type of tax problem and discovered this type of ideology, most likely through the internet. I agree that most of them are not dangerous and that only a small minority is. However, it's impossible to put numbers behind those individuals and groups.
You told us a little about some of the groups they belong to and the like. How did you encounter this phenomenon?
So this is a great question. When I first got out of law school, was on the child support contempt calendar in Santa Clara County. Now, the child support contempt calendar deals with matters where individuals are not have a court order to pay child support and they are willfully not paying. They are intentionally not paying child support. And one day when I was in the courthouse, I was stopped by an angry, muscular young man who said, "May I ask you a question?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "What are my sovereign rights?" Now, I didn't know what he was talking about. I assumed that he was talking about the divine right of kings. So I punted. I said, "What?" And he became a little bit condescending and difficult with me. He was not my client. He was someone else's client. And I watched him in the courtroom. I was mesmerized by what I saw. He had essentially single-handedly become so difficult to deal with that he turned a simple child support contempt matter that probably would have taken 3 or 4 minutes into something that took the better part of an hour, required additional courtroom security to come in, and ended with him doing time in jail after being tackled by the security in the courtroom. So having seen that, I became very interested in what it was that this young man was trying to espouse in the courts, because he seemed to believe it very, very strongly. And I knew that this came from somewhere, and that's what developed my interest in the subject.
I remember the first time I came upon somebody with these beliefs was in a traffic court. And it was somebody talking about a traffic ticket. But they didn't go so far as this. It was somebody who was a much, much more mild effect. Simply didn't believe that under the Uniform Commercial Code that entered into any contract. And in fact, they weren't the driver. They were the trustee for the driver. And I think that supports what I saw from the FBI and the Southern Poverty Law Center, that a lot of people that claim this just see it as some defense to the ticket or the support payment. And others, such as you're describing, are people that have really hardcore beliefs. But some of these folks get dangerous with those beliefs, do they not?
Some of these folks become very dangerous. There have been attacks on law enforcement. There have been plots against judges. And so in the worst case scenarios, these are violent individuals that law enforcement is dealing with on a regular basis. A sovereign citizen can become very, very, very agitated for a simple traffic stop. They may have been simply speeding. And when the police pull them over and ask them for their identification, they refuse to cooperate. And something that could be handled and should be handled very quickly and peacefully escalates in a fairly short amount of time into something where it can become a big problem for everyone involved. And there's a lot of examples of this on YouTube. There's one of the things about the sovereign citizen movement is that it's attracted a lot of attention on YouTube, both from people who believe in it, people who are interested in it, and on the other side, those who truly dislike sovereign citizens and everything that they stand for. So there's a great deal of videos that show sovereign citizens getting tased by the police, sovereign citizens getting arrested by the police, sovereign citizens getting tackled in courts of law. And these have become very popular on the internet. There is a subpopulation of people who really enjoys watching these types of videos. But to directly answer your question, yes, there is a spectrum. There's a spectrum that exists between those, the typical sovereign citizen who just is making trouble in the courts by clogging the courts, by being disruptive, by making nonsensical arguments, and those on the other extreme that are dangerous for law enforcement and are a danger really to everyone.
So you mentioned they're dangerous. Let's talk about some of the acts that are done by these individuals.
Yes. So again, there is a spectrum. I think it's very important to state from the onset, again, most people who get involved with sovereign citizen ideology, who espouse this ideology, are harmless. They're not violent people. I have not seen many examples here locally of sovereign citizens acting violently. Usually, these are people who are almost, I would describe them as cranks, people who talk in ways that seems like gibberish, both to the police and to judicial officials, but are generally law-abiding people and espouse this ideology only when they get into trouble with a speeding ticket or something minor like that. Other sovereign citizens will do things like not pay their taxes. They'll clog up the courts with frivolous lawsuits, frivolous liens. They'll file lawsuits and liens against public officials for the purpose of harassing them. They'll use fake money orders, fake personal checks, and the like when they deal with government agencies, banks, and businesses. They can hold illegal courts and issue warrants for the arrest of judges and police officers. And then it becomes, on the other end of the spectrum, even more dangerous, which is some sovereign citizens do commit physical assaults and even murders. They threaten judges. They threaten law enforcement professionals. They threaten government personnel. They will impersonate police officers. They'll impersonate diplomats. They'll use fake currency, passports, license plates, and driver's license for the purpose of wanting to start problems. They want to be stopped by law enforcement. They'll engineer white-collar scams, including mortgage fraud and so-called redemption schemes. I think that the average listener out there might remember sovereign citizens from an event that happened very recently. On July 3rd, members of a group calling themselves the Rise of the Moors were wearing tactical gear and carrying firearms when they refused to comply with Massachusetts State's troopers' directions to drop their weapons and ran into the woods. A shelter-in-place order was issued, and Interstate 95 in Massachusetts was closed until the police confirmed that the threat had been abated. 11 members were arrested for this incident that drew lots of media coverage here in the States and abroad internationally.
So I want to get to the history and origins, but some of our not-so-distant past, we remember hearing about some things that sound suspiciously like they're grounded in the same ideology. When we've heard about incidents such as Ruby Ridge or the Oklahoma City bombing, were these tied to similar ideology?
Yes, they were tied to ideologies that were similar. Also, it's important to note that ideologies can overlap. Often, sovereign citizen ideology, for historical reasons, is identified with the hard right. But I'd like to point out, members of the hard left use this ideology as well. It sometimes becomes an ideology of convenience. So it's difficult sometimes to say when people actually truly believe this and when they're just using it and manipulating it in order to avoid prosecution or in order to avoid legal consequences and to stay out of trouble, or to use it and manipulate it for the purpose of harassing others.
You responded to an earlier question mentioning that you really can't put a number on it. Why is that you feel that you can't put a number on the number of people out there with this belief?
Well, it's very hard to research this type of group, this type of individual, this type of ideology. It often does not operate openly. So there's no coherent organization that leads this. There's no meetings that are held. Generally, these groups and groups like sovereign citizens morph and change and evolve and devolve constantly. So someone who uses certain language can be called a sovereign citizen, but they may only be using it today for the purpose of trying to avoid paying a traffic ticket, or for the purpose of trying to make a traffic stop with the police officer difficult. And they may not really believe what they're saying, and they may not, after they find out in court that this isn't going to work or it doesn't work out for them, they may not continue along those lines. They may adopt other ideas and ideologies. So it's almost impossible to come up with a figure of how many people out there are sovereign citizens. And also the fact that the term itself is a vague term contributes to this difficulty.
You know, the last time there was an estimate I'm aware of in trying to estimate these numbers was in 2010. And as I mentioned earlier, the Southern Poverty Law Center estimated at that time there were about 200,000 people that were somewhat adhered to the ideology, about 100,000 of them were pretty hardcore. But as we've seen in the 11 years since, the political factions in the country have really developed into two very distinct groups with a lot of tribalism going on, more and more people being pushed to the extremes. And we've seen outbreaks that sound like they're somewhat closely linked with this in some of these incidents. So do you feel that those numbers are probably no longer good?
I think this is an excellent question. I also am familiar with the sources that you just cited. I suspect the reason that you cited those sources is that you looked into this and you did not find a lot of information on what the numbers are estimated to be. And that's why you're citing what could be considered dated sources. However, when I look into this, I find the same sources, and I don't find as much information recently, and certainly not information published by groups like the FBI or the Southern Poverty Law Center that was publishing about this 10 years ago. So when I saw that, I asked myself, is it possible that this group is actually in decline? And the interesting thing that I found was it doesn't appear to be in decline, because the activity that's happening with people who are espousing this ideology was going up, not down, in the last few years. And so I would agree that the numbers are difficult to estimate, and that part of the problem here is that the sources themselves, the sources of information that we have on it, are not as good as they could be and should be. And I would hope that we would get better research on this particular movement. Secondly, to your other point of groups that are doing something similar or espousing ideas that are similar. This is also an excellent point. There is a growing number of people in this country who are frustrated on a number of different lines. They're frustrated in the fact within their social economic circumstances. They don't believe in the system. They don't believe in the court system. If they've been through the court system, they don't think they got a fair shake. They don't trust lawyers. They don't trust the elite. They feel powerless. At the same time, the schools are not teaching civics. They're not teaching the law. And ignorance leads to powerlessness or a sense of powerlessness. What sovereign citizen ideology and other ideologies that could be considered fake news that are propagated on the internet and in other places, what they have in common is they give someone who believes that they are not empowered a sense that they belong to a group that has a kind of esoteric knowledge, that they understand things that other people don't. And if they just say these magic words in court, their legal problems will disappear. Or if they say these magic words to the police when they get pulled over for a speeding ticket, the magic words will have such a power on the police that the police can't give them a speeding ticket. They think that they're turning the world upside down. Instead of the police officer being the one in power over them or the judge in a power over them, they are the person who's holding everyone else. Everyone else has to respond to them. They're the one who's controlling things because they have this secret knowledge and know how to use it as a weapon.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're looking at the sovereign citizen movement, what it means to you, what it means to national security. I'd like to start by inviting anyone who is personally familiar with claims of sovereignty to call in. We'll respect your privacy, but we'd really like to hear from you. Or anybody with information or has any questions for my guest. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that's national, the sovereign citizen movement and what that means to national security, or even just ask what all this means to you, or when these folks should grab your attention. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. So I'd like to start, we're obviously not going to get too far before this station break in a few minutes, but I would like to start a little bit on the history and origins. What can you tell us a little bit about where these started?
So the history and the origins of this line of thinking appear to have begun somewhere around 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve. It was, in some people's view, this weird, complicated instrument for controlling the monetary system. And some people saw it as sinister. These ideas also get into some of the things like the Federal Reserve conspiracies that have always been claimed. But where we really saw it take off was in the 1960s. In right-wing movements that were inherently racist and anti-Semitic. So some people have said that, some researchers have said, that this movement was founded by William Potter Gale, who is a former member of the John Birch Society. He formed a group of anti-government Christian identity adherents who mistrusted state and federal officials. They believed that non-white people were not human and that Jews possessed a satanic plot to take over the world. They identified themselves by a term that I have a hard time pronouncing called posse comitatus, which is Latin for power of the county, and centered around the idea that local sheriffs are the highest governmental authority. Posse Comitatus is based on the Sheriff's Act of 1887, which allowed sheriffs to form a posse that would assist them in hunting down and arresting criminals. Gale believed that they served under common law, laws based on their interpretation of the Bible rather than civil law, i.e. legitimate laws formed by the American legal system. The activities of Mr. Gale's posse, many of which were criminal, included the refusal to pay taxes, filing property liens, and committing violence against public officials. These actions, which were established by his group, have become customary in today's sovereign citizens movement. What has changed since the movement's inception is the white supremacist ideology that initially dominated it. Contemporary sovereign citizens hold varying racial ideologies and include a variety of people, most commonly white and African American. And I would point out, I believe that African Americans are probably the single largest group that – a single largest growing group that is using this type of ideology today.
You know, I'm starting to get some questions from folks that are asking me to ask the questions for them. And I think we could get one of them in before we break. But I've been asked to ask you if you would comment on the influence of former presidential candidate Beau Gritz and Patriot Movement advocate William Bill Cooper, both of whom are now deceased. And for those who don't know, Sylvester Stallone based his Rambo character on Colonel Beau Gritz, who was a Vietnam veteran and Green Beret.
That's a very interesting question. That is something I think we should take up after the commercial break.
It's not a two-minute answer. And for those that want to know, those are both extremely potent influencers for the sovereign citizen conspiracies that were advanced in the 1990s and advocated for armed militias. It was actually Beau Gritz who went in and negotiated the surrender of Randy Weaver, you heard mentioned earlier, of Ruby Ridge. So I think he may be onto something. The other question I was going to ask you after we come back from the break is about the Boogaloo movement and whether you feel that the Boogaloo conspirators are also adherents of sovereign citizenship, if that's really where these people are coming from. Little scary thought there. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
On the next Jura Call, we'll discuss the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, which progressives say is their best opportunity to advance their priorities. It includes measures to deal with the climate crisis and would expand Medicare to cover glasses, hearing aids, and dental work. It would also provide free community college and preschool for 3 and 4-year-olds. What do you want to know about the details and the politics behind the bill? Join the next Jura Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Join the conversation tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Your Call with Rose Aguilar. Right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
The questions I left you with are a bit concerning in the sense that we mentioned a couple of particular instances. One of them would be Colonel Beau Gritz, who, of course, was the Rambo character, and particular adherents, perhaps the Boogaloo movement. But I think you may have answered those already. And in answering those questions, is it really easy to pin down, given that there's no centralized movement at all, no centralized leadership?
That's exactly the problem. So because there is no centralized movement, there is no foundational text that came out, no seminal text that came out, sovereign citizens are not all alike. Some of them can be influenced by individuals, and some of them can be influenced by simply what they hear on YouTube. Also, a lot of people get indoctrinated with this in the prison system. It tends to go through the prison system where people will become – they will encounter this and they will start using it. And they'll start filing all kinds of stuff where they represent themselves in the courts, these voluminous documents that don't make a lot of sense and clog the courts up with this type of pseudo-linguistic or pseudo-legalistic nonsense.
A bit over 3 years ago, we touched on this topic on this program. We had with us a third guest who was a brilliant white-collar criminal defense attorney, but she came across this as a research attorney for the courts. And she was surprised at these really convoluted arguments, these convoluted positions being advanced by some of these folks in prison that she had to decipher, and was curious why none of these individuals seem to be represented by attorneys. Have you had a chance to come across that at all?
Well, I have some thoughts on this, and I think she made this point herself, which is one of the reasons why these individuals represent themselves is that if, for example, a sovereign citizen were to come to me for representation purposes and wanted me to make the types of arguments that they would like to be made on their behalf, that would trigger some problems with the rules of professional conduct and legal ethics. The other thing is that they have a very selective use of case law. They'll find one sentence in a case that would appear to support their position and use it out of context. They will cite things that the Magna Carta, for example, or they'll cite documents that don't even exist. One of the things that I've seen in court, the young angry man that I mentioned earlier claimed that the United States Supreme Court had ruled in a case, and he gave a case name, that child support had been declared unconstitutional. Well, this case doesn't exist. And so as a matter of professional ethics, an attorney can't cite bad law intentionally. They can't cite make-believe legal cases. They have to actually research the Constitution. They have to research statutes. They have to research case law and cite it properly. And so I think that, one, most sovereign citizens become pro se in part for that reason, for the legal ethics reason. The second reason is often they are from the lower socioeconomic class. So if they have a civil problem, if they have a problem in family court, they often can't afford representation. And then number three, very crudely, they're very difficult individuals to get along with. And therefore, even if they do have some resources to hire an attorney and go to that attorney, the attorney may choose not to represent them, may choose that this may be a case that they would like to pass on. So for those reasons, that's why I think you're seeing that in the courts.
I had a family member who used to go online. So if somebody felt ill, she would go online, look up some of the symptoms, and diagnose it. And sometimes she may be onto something, but unfortunately, a lot of times, without the training in medicine and the ability to make the observations herself and really rule things out, it was almost random. The results. Is this the legal equivalent of the person that did a little bit of legal research to identify and diagnose ailments?
I think it can be. It's the equivalent of the person who goes online to diagnose ailments but goes to a site that is run by a quack. And so they are diagnosing an ailment based on bad information on a site that may even be fraudulent information, maybe intentionally putting bad information out there. In the case of Sovereign Citizens, they will go online often. They may interact with someone who's claiming to be an attorney, who's practicing an unauthorized practice of law. They may just be interacting with someone who doesn't know what they're talking about and is not intentionally misleading them. They can buy and download forms that to them appear to be legitimate forms and that they have been told will work in a court of law. They've been told that if they say magic words in court, that the court will be suspended. There are many videos on YouTube of sovereign citizens claiming to have won their case in court when all they did was show up to an arraignment and become disruptive and get a pretrial date or another court date. The case was continued. That probably was going to be the process anyways. And so they're misrepresenting what happened, but a person who's not familiar with the courts and how the courts work and how the process works and doesn't understand the laws and how to research the laws can be deceived by these videos and can be deceived by a charming or charismatic personality on the internet who is selling them an idea that they want to believe in. This person is offering them the solution to their problem. You have a tax problem, I have the solution. You download these forms on my site, you send them into the IRS, or you file them in court, and your tax problem goes away. If your problem is child support, you say these words in child support court, and your child support order goes away. If your problem is driving on a suspended license, or if you get pulled over by the police and you say these magic words, the police must let you go or your ticket must be dismissed. And so that I would agree that going on the internet is similar in that the internet is both a place where people can get good information and bad information, and it spreads bad information very, very quickly. And this is a kind of fake news that has spread very, very quickly through the internet.
The next question I have may be a little hard to answer because it seems that these groups, while growing, are becoming incredibly decentralized. But we talked a little bit about the history and a little bit about the origins. Are there any core beliefs that are common to people that follow this line of reasoning?
Well, the core belief is that they subscribe to an alternative version of American history, and that at some point in American history, a corporation secretly usurped the United States government. It then went bankrupt and sought aid. That aid may have come from international bankers. It may have come from individual ethnic groups, and that as collateral, this corporation offered the financiers, us, the people of the United States, our birth certificates, our social security cards, and entered into a contract to enslave us. And so the central belief here, the central beliefs that keep reoccurring is this type of conspiratorial idea, along with just on a basic level, an anti-governmental stance. The government is not legitimate, and therefore the laws of the government are not legitimate. The courts are not legitimate. The legal process is not legitimate. And they have found the solution for the average person to break out from under this tyranny.
What are some of the contradictions of these core beliefs?
So the belief itself, the term itself, sovereign citizen, is oxide, moronic, and contradictory. It is contradictory to physically remain present in the United States of America and yet claim to be sovereign. So one of the things that sovereign citizens often will say in court is that the court is run under admiralty law. Well, that simply is not true. They'll say that they do not consent to jurisdiction, or they'll say they don't consent to the jurisdiction of the United States or the state of California or the county that they're in or the city that they're in. But of course, they did consent to it just by being physically present here. Some sovereign citizens will go so far as to try to renounce their American citizenship and go to Mexico. Well, or even another foreign country. A lot of them go to Mexico. Well, when they're in Mexico, they are going to be ruled by Mexican law, whether they renounce their American citizenship or not. There was a case where an individual apparently bought land in someplace in Africa and wanted to start his own country where he would be sovereign there. And this just shows kind of the extreme that some people are going to. People who will say, well, I'm going to get a houseboat and live in the middle of the ocean. Well, good luck with that.
And I'm curious, does a sovereign citizen movement extend beyond the borders of the United States?
Yes. So sovereign citizens, this ideology, while it's inherently an American phenomenon, there are similar movements in Australia, mostly in the English-speaking world, in Australia, in England, in Canada, in New Zealand. They often are not exactly the same. They have also existed for some time. They have a similar anti-government belief system. However, because of the internet, these groups often merge and morph together now. So it is an international phenomenon, but it is still largely an American phenomenon.
I have a listener that's been asking if Jim Jones was a sovereign citizen.
Wow, that's a good question. I'm not as familiar with Jim Jones and the People's Temple and their ideology. He very well may have been. I just don't know. I'm not familiar enough with his case.
Another person he cites, and we spoke of earlier, William Cooper. Bill Cooper started as a UFO conspirator, but his life ended with a paranoid, violent conflict with sheriff's deputies outside of his Arizona home. And he brings that up because it seems to reflect where somebody with these tendencies and how it might interact with psychotic outbursts. Most of these folks are perhaps bright and misplaced. Is there a psychotic overrepresentation here, or is that really misplaced? I haven't seen it myself.
So I suspect that there probably is a connection here between mental health and the sovereign citizens movement and other ideologies, extremist ideologies that are conspiratorial like this. I think there needs to be more research in this area. So to answer your question, I can't answer the question directly. I don't have research that would state that. But my suspicion is that, yes, there almost certainly is a connection between mental health and this particular movement.
What advice do you have for somebody who wants to assert a sovereign citizen identity?
I would advise them to have very low expectations of how this is going to work out in court for them. I think you're not going to get far. You're not going to be successful. And I would highly, highly recommend that you don't represent yourself in court using this ideology. So my advice is to, this does not work, don't try it.
We're running, we're heading towards the end of the hour. There's a couple of things I wanted to focus on for the remaining time. One of them is any thoughts you may have on why this persists, why this hasn't run its course.
This is a very interesting topic. So, again, as I stated earlier, ignorance leads to powerlessness. We're not teaching civics in school anymore. People are, the average American is ignorant of the laws. They don't know the laws. They don't know how to look up and do legal research on themselves. This ideology appeals to people who feel powerless. It appeals to someone who's who might be an isolated person, who spends a lot of time by themselves, who's not happy with how their life turned out, who has gotten into some trouble, be it with taxes or failure to pay child support or in the criminal courts, or just has gotten – their life is not going the way they want it to. They may also – I see this with people who go through custody disputes and it didn't go the way they thought it should have gone. So also in society, there's just a growing dissatisfaction. Our culture is becoming increasingly toxic, and the internet has become a breeding ground for these kinds of ideologies and for people. The internet gives a platform to people who didn't have a platform before. So before, an individual who's dissatisfied is kind of left to them to themselves. But now they can go online and connect with other people who are also dissatisfied and people who are looking to take advantage of that. Part of this also is that there is a desire for someone whose life is not going well to become powerful and to become part of a group, to have part of this esoteric knowledge where they can feel that now I am a member of an elite because I understand reality better than you do, better than the police, better than the legal professionals, better than the elites.
John in Daly City, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hey, I just had a question. It's an interesting show, but I'm just wondering, what is the difference between, say, an individual declaring that the law doesn't apply to him, and then when you get instances like large groups of people deciding, you know, that certain laws just don't apply, like immigration? Because it seems pretty similar to me. Any thoughts on that?
Do you get a comment on that?
On how laws like the immigration laws don't matter? Can you be more specific?
No, what he's asking is there safety in numbers when groups of people, it may be political subdivisions, it may be organized groups, but where they feel that the laws don't apply to them or certain laws don't apply to them, why are they different than some of these individuals who basically say, well, your nation's laws don't apply to me. I'm an individual citizen of my own country. Did I get that right, John?
Yeah, that was actually a good summation. Thank you.
Okay, so if an individual American, a person born here in America, decides that the laws don't apply to them versus someone who's born in a foreign country and comes here illegally and therefore is not cooperating with or intentionally violating the immigration laws, is that the question?
I don't mean foreigners. I mean, say, large groups of citizens, of U.S. citizens. You know, even people in the Congress saying, you know, we know this is, I guess, technically illegal, but we're all going to basically agree that, I guess, we know better, you could say, and so we're just going to sort of poo-poo the laws and not follow them.
That the law does not apply to them. I think that there's a connection here in that people in Congress or the elites who are perceived as intentionally breaking the laws with the belief that the law does not apply to them, and someone who is not following the traffic laws or the tax laws or the child support law, child support orders, are both doing something in the sense that they are both violating laws knowingly and then making, I guess in a sense, are making a justification for doing that.
John, as we're running out of time, I want to give you a quote from a case before the United States Supreme Court. This, in fact, goes back to 1928. But this may be a little bit of what you're trying to express. Men born to freedom are naturally alert to repel invasion of their liberty by evil-minded rulers. The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning but without understanding. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become law unto himself. It invites anarchy. To declare that the administration of the criminal law, the end justifies the means. To declare that the government may commit crimes in order to secure the conviction of a private criminal would bring terrible retribution. That's the dissent from a United States Supreme Court decision, Olmstead versus United States, in 1928. I won't keep you going. Just real quickly, if I could say.
So I've been reading recently about Civil War and Reconstruction and pre-Civil War, and I find it sort of a little similar because I'm pretty sympathetic to having better immigration laws and even opening the country more, but I just feel like it would be worthwhile to do it legally. I mean, it's almost as if before the Civil War, the abolitionists just decided, well, we know we're right, so we're not going to bother changing the laws. And I think it was worthwhile changing the laws. So I think it is kind of, I guess it sounds old-fashioned maybe, but I think it actually is good to have laws that are enforced. And if you disagree with them, you know, try to change them legally and then follow them. Anyway, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. It was an interesting point of view, and I appreciate you sharing them with us and joining us. We're running low on time. We have maybe 5 minutes left, and I didn't want to skip over what I think is a salient question. Where do we go from here? How do we stop this from continuing?
Well, there's a couple of thoughts I have on this, and one is simply better education, better civics education specifically, teaching people how the court system works, how the legal system works, how to research the laws on your own. I think, as the caller suggested, how the political process works, how to change laws, how laws are created. And there's something else that I would point out, which is, as an attorney, a lot of sovereign citizens don't believe that they can get a fair shake in court. And part of the problem is that they don't see that their attorney has advocated zealously for them. As you know, most legal actions, most criminal cases, and also most civil cases resolve in some type of settlement before trial. And perhaps that's part of the problem. Perhaps if people were advocating more zealously on behalf of these individuals, they wouldn't feel the need and they wouldn't be attracted to this type of extremist ideology as an out. If they thought that they could participate in the system fairly, and if they thought that the system worked fairly for them, they wouldn't be so quick to see these types of arguments as attractive.
I practice both criminal defense but also juvenile delinquency defense. And just by way of example, I've been in trial the last 2 days in a juvenile case that finished today. Notwithstanding where I thought the outcome would be, and I could have settled for the very outcome we received today, but it became painfully obvious to me that the young man I was representing, who was very pleased with the outcome today, but he really needed to understand it. He needed to have everything aired out to where he could see how things play out and really grasp it, really understand that somebody went to bat for him, expressed his point of view in those areas where it prevailed, where it didn't, in order for him to really walk away feeling he had a clean shake. Is that the kind of advocacy you're suggesting here?
I think that the example you just gave touches on both points I made. The need for greater education on how the legal system and the courts work. So I think a very high number of people don't understand the process. They don't understand whether or not their attorney did a good job for them and are not able to make that type of evaluation. And that's a problem. And they also don't believe that the system is entirely fair. They don't believe through their own experience that they got a fair shake, that they got to – that their side of the story was ever said or brought out. Unfortunately, many public defenders have way too many cases. Their caseload is simply enormous, and they do not always have the time to give to every individual to hear what their side of the story is in full or to fully investigate the case. And many people who go through that then believe that, well, they see the courts as run by elites that are uncaring and unsympathetic. And so there's a natural hostility, and some citizen ideology gives them what they think is going to be the remedy.
And having had this conversation with you previously, I know that you didn't mean that to mean that the public defenders aren't fighting or doing a good job.
Absolutely not.
And especially here in the city where they do an amazing job. But what they might not have is the luxury of being able to sit down with everybody and explain what they've been doing and really lay it out the way that would behoove them if they had the numbers of people and the level of public support that would allow them to spend more time with each individual and fully make sure the client understands.
They have not been given the resources that they need to be able to do that. And I know in other places in the country where there are public defenders who have 150-plus cases. Well, if they spent 20 minutes on the case each week, that would be a very difficult task to keep up with.
There are places in the country where they might give $250 or $300 to fight a case, including a death penalty case. Happily, we don't live in one of those states. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we take a look at the sovereign citizen movement. My guest tonight has been San Mateo attorney David Nazaro. Tonight's show was produced by David Nazaro and yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6, where we will attempt to share our quarterly update on landlord-tenant law. Best of all, we will take your calls and answer your questions. And again, a big thanks to tonight's guest, David Nazaro, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. This is KALW San Francisco Bay Area.